Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. This afternoon, President Trump is formalizing his plans for steel and aluminum tariffs, part of his effort to restore manufacturing in the United States, a strategy that many don't believe is the right one. Joining us now is Mark Muro, who's a senior fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Mark, first describe the state of manufacturing in this country right now. Is it as bad as President Trump has said?
Well, manufacturing, certainly came out of a brutal decade before the financial crisis, the early 2000s, as China entered the global marketplace after the WTO, saw true carnage in the industry or the sector. After the crisis, there was a good surge with strong export around the world and progress made on automation and productivity gains. Unfortunately, those have begun to flatten. And so currently the sector, I would say, is stable but not surging in productivity.
Now, there has been, though, if you look back to the year 2000, there's been a sizable drop in manufacturing jobs, which Trump blames on bad trade deals. How much is trade responsible for what's going on?
The industry and sector have been changing radically, especially due to automation. So even absent the trade factor, employment growth would be constrained and there certainly would have been losses. So there's a lot going on here and it's not all about trade. Much of it is about productivity and automation as well.
There's a McKinsey report from November of last year about how to revitalize U.S. manufacturing, and nowhere in it does it mention adding tariffs on imports?
No. I mean, I think the crucial challenges lay around productivity, talent, making sure that we have the right kind of in-demand skills for today's modern factory. And then I talk a lot about the importance of strong regional ecosystems, dense supply chains in the United States and in our regions. You know, tariffs are not likely part of the short list of what is needed by most sectors in manufacturing.
Another thing that President Trump has done in an effort to boost U.S. jobs and U.S. manufacturing is he's gone after individual companies. Let's take a little listen here to a montage that we put together.
Companies are not going to leave the United States anymore without consequences. Not going to happen. It's not going to happen. I'll tell you right now.
We're going to get things coming. We're going to get Apple to start building their damn computers and things in this country instead of in other countries.
I can tell you this. When Carrier and Ford and Nabisco leaving Chicago with their big plant, they're moving to Mexico. I'm not eating Oreos anymore. You know that.
Does that make a difference to have the president get involved in individual companies' decisions about where they're putting their factories and their jobs?
I actually do think it's important to have the president of the United States actually signaling that he has the back of manufacturing as a whole. I think it becomes more questionable and less useful the narrower the aperture gets. And that applies to very narrow tariffs for steel and aluminum. But the company-by-company approach to economic development is likely not the right way forward. What we need to be building is broad capabilities in technology, in skills, and again, in these regional places.
You've mentioned automation a couple of times, and obviously for some manufacturers, that may be a great thing. It allows them to make more stuff faster, cheaper. For jobs, it's not so great. But how big of a part of our troubles in manufacturing is the automation of it?
Absent automation, the United States would not have the productivity to compete globally. So automation is part of the solution, but it absolutely must be taken seriously as a factor in the labor market and clearly does reduce employment in especially rote middle skill occupations. So it's a two-edged sword, but I think it's not solely negative. Where we don't have automation, we likely don't have a presence in the industry.
Why is it so important for a country like this to have a strong manufacturing sector? There are some who would say we should be an information economy at this point.
Well, the only problem with the idea that we simply can do the design or just be an information economy is the fact that much of the innovative activity in the United States is actually tied up with manufacturing. It turns out that when you lose the manufacturing, you sometimes begin to lose the expertise to do the design too. And in multiple industries, we've seen the one lead to the other unexpectedly. So I think there is a new conclusion in the last decade or so that manufacturing is important, but for different reasons. You know, it's not solely important for employing millions and millions of people. It's also important to the United States' ability to innovate, to create new things, to learn. So there are new reasons for manufacturing's importance. And it's not, you know, your parents manufacturing anymore.
That's Mark Muro, who is a senior fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Great. Thanks, Jeremy. Take care.
Now to the opioid crisis. A new report from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention finds opioid overdoses increased nearly 30% across the country in just 14 months between 2016 and 2017. The CDC called it a wake-up call, and states are looking for strategies to deal with it. In Arizona, lawmakers have passed a handful of new laws. Many of them limit access to prescription painkillers. But there are concerns it won't be enough, especially in rural, hard-to-reach communities. Will Stone from member station KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
John says there's always been a drug problem in his hometown. It's just the drug of choice that's changed.
A couple years ago, it was all meth that was around this area, and now it's all opioids.
The 24-year-old is 2 weeks sober when I meet him at a coffee shop on the edges of Kingman, Arizona. We're not using his real name because of his history of illegal drug use. John says he first tried opioids when he was only 10 or 11.
Yeah, I started with pills. Hanging out at school, it's everywhere.
Eventually, John moved on to heroin. He's acutely aware of how drugs have hijacked his life.
It's like an on and off battle all the time of being an addict. People get clean, then they get soaked, you know, and then they relapse, and then they get clean. It is with me, at least. I just want to find a point where I'm sober.
Not easy in this rural, relatively poor corner of Arizona. There are few treatment options. John drives nearly an hour to see his doctor, who gives him medication for withdrawal symptoms. That's where he first saw a flyer for a local group called HOPE, Heroin Overdose Prevention Education. So he called the phone number.
It blew my mind. I didn't know they were doing that out here, we need it for sure.
That's how we ended up here, picking up clean needles and naloxone, a drug that reverses opioid overdoses and can save lives. He'll give it to his friends, he says. No one else is.
One person I've seen out of the couple hundred people that I know that use.
Since June, more than 950 people are believed to have died from opioid overdoses in Arizona. As part of its response, the state has given out thousands of naloxone kits and pushed to have first responders carry them. But reaching IV drug users is still proving difficult. Robert DeVries is the police chief for Kingman.
We didn't see this coming, we being law enforcement, as quickly as what we should have in regards to the pill abuse.
In 2016, Mojave County, population 200,000, had the most prescriptions per capita in Arizona. Governor Doug Ducey has held it up as emblematic of the crisis, a place where doctors dole out millions of pills. But DeVries says the trend is changing.
Heroin is the leading cause that we are seeing of our overdose deaths.
And that's true across the country. Heroin and the even more potent fentanyl are driving the death rate, especially as states tamp down on prescribing. Deaths from heroin tripled between 2012 and 2016 in Arizona, and it's now the most common drug found in those who overdose, right ahead of oxycodone.
We are struggling, we know that, and we're trying. And that's where we've said to the state, quit using this as a poster child if you're not going to help us with some resources.
State lawmakers took a big step toward that in January, passing a host of new laws to restrict prescribing, eliminate barriers to effective treatment, and protect drug users who call 911 in good faith to report an overdose.
We're not going to arrest our way out of this situation. We need to take a three-pronged approach. That's education, that's treatment, and of course, enforcement.
Arizona was careful not to force existing patients to lower their doses, which could push even more to street drugs. The rules instead apply to new patients and ramp up oversight of doctors. But Dr. William Maroney cautions.
Prescription drug laws are all about 4 or 5 years too late.
Maroney is the former president of the American Osteopathic Academy of Addiction Medicine. We spoke via Skype.
It's flipped. It's inverted now. And a governor or licensing and regulatory affairs or legislature, they cannot touch the heroin and the fentanyl that's going to come into this country to kill people.
He says only treatment can reach those people, and hopefully, in time. For Here and Now, I'm Will Stone.
Today in Syria, an aid convoy traveling into the rebel-held enclave of eastern Ghouta was put on hold. It's the second time this week that violence has disrupted the delivery of much-needed food and medical supplies to the area, which has been under siege for years. In recent weeks, a massive government bombing campaign has left more than 700 people dead. Yves Decord is Director General of the International Committee of the Red Cross, which helped lead the convoys, along with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent and the UN. His group also coordinates aid in more than 80 other countries. Yves Decord joins us as part of our series of conversations with leaders that we call View from the Top. Yves, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
What's the latest with this convoy?
The latest is that we have not been able to go back to eastern Ghouta. We are pushing to be able to do that, I hope, in the next coming days. This is critical because a one-off convoy is totally useless. What you need to be able to be is really to go back again and again. I think we have 400,000 people there, besieged for months, if not years, and the situation now is extremely difficult for the people.
Tell me more about the conditions on the ground there as far as you've heard from your people. I mean, we're seeing reporting that people, citizens, have been living in basements for weeks at a time, unable to emerge. There's malnutrition issues. Children are dying as they're waiting for the aid to get to them.
The situation for the people, for the population in eastern Ghouta is extraordinarily difficult, but it has been now years on pressure on these people. They are under siege, if you want, for years. And of course, over the last few weeks, the bombing has increased dramatically. So what you have first health problem, really dramatic health problem, basic. People just wanted no support anymore. Hospitals have been bombed, so there's really no health support. That's one of the elements. Mm. B, you have major, water problems. Water is cut, difficult to get water right now. Heating problems, it's winter there. And I think the most important one is security. Imagine you're living in a basement, you don't know what's happening, and constant bombing. And people are not stupid. They are in Syria, so they know what has happened in Aleppo and in Homs. And they expect the next days to be very, very difficult.
There is an aspect to the story that I simply don't understand, and that is this convoy that tried to get in and partially got in earlier this week did have some medical supplies on board. The government, as far as the reporting goes, the Syrian government, allegedly stripped that convoy of these medical supplies, desperately needed medical supplies. Why would they do that?
Health has been one of the battlefield of the Syrian war from day one. And that's a huge concern that we have. If you look at the numbers of hospitals, clinics, doctors which have been targeted, bombed, killed, it's just amazing. So what is terrible with the situation right now in Syria, but you can see that also in Yemen or other places, that healthcare right now is at the target, really strategically targeted by the warring body, being the government on or the rebels, in order to put pressure on the people. And yes, that's clear. You see that on a daily basis, including when it comes to convoy.
Russia has suggested a 5-hour daily pause in fighting to let the humanitarian aid in to eastern Ghouta. Is that enough?
No.
And frankly, it's not happening.
No, well, absolutely not for the people. The question is not ours. The question is, please, let's respect what the Security Council said. The Security Council of the United Nations, with all the country, said 30 days of ceasefire. That's what is needed for the people, not the 5 hours a day. Absolutely not. Hours on the day that won't make the trick. Absolutely not.
I have a list in front of me, the 10 countries that your organization has the most direct mission in across the world. Syria, of course, we've talked about that. Iraq, South Sudan, Yemen, Nigeria, Somalia, Congo, Afghanistan, Ukraine, and Myanmar. Outside of Syria, what hotspot across the globe keeps you up at night?
All of them. Really all of them. You can start with Yemen. I think Yemen is, underreported. It's a country which already is poor, going through very, very difficult time. And now on the top of that, you have a new war 2 years ago started, put an enormous pressure on the social system, on the social fabric of the country. A lot of needs, a health system which is on the verge to collapse and so weak that not able anymore to cope with endemic issues like cholera. Imagine we have cholera again, 21st century. Biggest modern epidemic of cholera in Yemen. My God.
What are you doing there?
Oh, it's a huge operation for us. I think the really things you need to know for us is we are trying to not just be in the capitals, but trying to be everywhere where it's happening. Permanent presence, negotiating on a daily basis, access for people, for ambulances, for our staff, in Sana'a, in Sada, in Aden, in different places, trying to protect the people as much as we can, trying also to convince the warring party that they need to allow people to access what is important for them. Knowing most importantly that in Yemen, one of the big issues is that it's a country which is importing food, drugs, doesn't have that. Also guarantee that the warring party also lets the food and the drugs coming in the country.
Doctors have left. Hospitals are destroyed. Have you gotten a foothold on the cholera epidemic at all?
We are contributing, of course, to somewhat help, but you have to know this is huge. So we are able to somewhat help, if I look at all my team, to manage kind of 20 to 25% of the caseload, but there's still 75% to manage. And I think you can't manage with one organization a crisis which is hitting a country. Here, again, I think we have to learn that investment in a health system within the crisis is a critical one. You mentioned doctors are leaving. It's true. Nurses are not paid for a long, long time. So I think it's also one of the reasons I was in Washington right now to discuss also with the World Bank and also the development actors. They start to realize that it's time to guarantee that the health system do not collapse completely.
It must be incredibly expensive, not only to help rebuild the health system in Yemen, but for each of these places that we just listed across the world that you're in. I know your budget. Last month, one of your colleagues at the organization said that your budget has increased by 80% since 2010.
It's true, yes.
What's going on?
Look at your list. If I look at what is happening in the Middle East, if I look at what's going on also in Sahel, for example, on the top of that, one of the big problems is there's no conflict which is stopping.
But hasn't that always been the case?
It has been the case, but maybe what is new is there is a level of instability. State nations are not able anymore to produce collective solutions. Look at the UN Security Council. They have never, ever talked so much about one issue, Syria, with so little result. It's amazing.
And non-state actors as well.
And, of course, an emerging of new so-called armed group. There is more in 6 years than the previous 60 years in Congo, in Syria, in Yemen. You see fragmentation of the groups, a lot of non-state armed group, which makes life of people extremely difficult. So, yes, no other choice than for us than to do more.
You're here, so I have to ask you another question, which is that you personally announced something kind of troubling for your organization last month. 21 of your staff members dismissed after it was discovered that they had paid for sexual services over the course of 3 years while they were deployed in places across the world. How did that happen?
We have a very strong code of conduct, which is very good, since 2006, who says prostitution, zero. What happens is we have to be better in the way we are managing our compliance. And you maybe have to say one thing about our culture. Everything is about gaining trust. We are living and building our work based on our ability to connect with people. First, the people affected, but also the warring parties. We don't operate with guns. We are not protected as such. So it's our fragility, which is our strength. And of course, me as a CEO, I can't tolerate that among my 18,000 professionals, I have people who forget why doing it. I know they're under pressure. I know things are very difficult when you are on the front line. But I'm deeply convinced in terms of culture, we don't have any choices than to show perfect example. And I'm absolutely ready to be transparent and take the action.
You can imagine that the irony is difficult for people to understand. You're a humanitarian group.
Absolutely. But can I just be clear? Here we're not talking about abuse of power. We're not talking about having sex with people affected. We're talking about paid transactional sex.
Which,
right?
Some people say is a power dynamic for sure.
I agree. That's why we decided, just to clarify, but that's also why we have a very clear code of conduct. We do not allow prostitution. And that's very clear. So that's why we fired these people. And I wanted to be open and clear about the fact that, yes, it's happening also in our organization, but also a clear message to everybody. We will take action.
Does it go beyond the organization? Oxfam, as you know, also had a similar problem in Haiti. Its workers had been paying for sex in Haiti. Is it something about the sector?
I don't think so. I think there is a moment where in our society, attention is shifting. And I think there is more pressure when it comes to behavior. And it's a good news. B is very clearly we're living in a world where, in fact, colleagues, friends, but also people affected, they're also expressing themselves much more. They're much more clear about what they expect from us. So I wouldn't say it's a sector problem. I think it's just an interrelationship issue. I've seen that in armies, in government, in churches. So there is something happening right now in our world. And I think what is important is that we need to be extraordinarily clear about our behavior.
Well, we talked about your budget being 80% higher than it was in 2010. It's $1.8 billion. It's a lot of money. You need a lot of money to operate. Does something like this affect your reputation, your ability to raise the cash you need?
Now, what affects our ability to operate is much more the fact that people will have a sense that humanitarian in general are maybe not behaving as they should. So I think people will not make a difference between us or other. And I think globally, that's an issue. What is for me, but really the most important, though, is the relationship that we are establishing with people and community affected around the world. They are central to us. If they don't trust us, we're out of business. We don't work through partner. It's my colleagues, my friends directly working really on the ground in the most difficult places. So what is critical for us as an indicator, if you want, is are we able to maintain trust when it comes to the relationship on a daily basis between people and us? And I would say, yes, we are.
Yves Decourt, Director General of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Another big merger announcement today in the healthcare industry. Insurance company Cigna will buy Express Scripts in a deal worth $67 billion. Joining us with the details is Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with the players here. Cigna, a big health insurance company a lot of people have heard of, or maybe they interact with Cigna on a regular basis. What does Express Scripts do?
So they are a pharmacy benefits management company. And what that is basically a middleman. What they do is they buy pharmaceuticals from either drug makers or wholesalers. And they work to negotiate prices and rebates with the drug makers in an attempt to get lower costs for their consumers and insurers. Most of their customers are actually health insurance plans.
And Cigna paid a premium for Express Scripts, paying more than the company's shares were worth. Why is it worth it to do that for Cigna? Why do they want this?
Right. So it's pretty common, obviously, for a company to pay a premium in a takeover like this. In this case, it's about 31%. And they do that in order to make sure that the target company's board of directors and shareholders get on board. And in Cigna's case, it's just clear that there's a lot of mergers and consolidation going on in this industry, specifically between health insurers and pharmacy benefits companies like this. So they're basically playing defense, trying to get competitive with other companies that are merging in this space.
And two of those other companies that have recently merged in this space are there was a $69 billion merger between the insurance company Aetna and the drugstore chain CVS. There have been reports that Walgreens is trying to buy AmerisourceBergen. Why is all this activity happening now?
Well, I think, you know, as the healthcare costs have gotten so high in recent years, these companies really are getting competitive and sort of there's a little bit of a keeping up with the Joneses element to it. Remember, CVS itself also merged with a pharmacy benefits manager in recent years. And the big sort of scare to the industry is Amazon.com is starting to get into the healthcare business. Earlier this year, they announced they would team up with Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, and JP Morgan Chase on a new venture that's aimed at lowering health costs for their employees. So the competition is really heating up throughout the healthcare, health insurance and pharmacy benefits industry. So, you know, these companies are really sort of beefing up and combining to try to stay competitive.
Any chance regulators will block this deal?
It's a good question. You know, there have been several similar deals blocked. Anthem, another health insurance company, tried to take over Cigna, and that was blocked because of antitrust concerns. So it's possible this one could get some scrutiny, but I think the way it was designed, the way these two companies targeted each other was in attempts to be sort of one of the last big consolidations that the regulators might allow.
Will consumers notice anything?
You know, I doubt they'll see much change. I mean, ideally, the goal, at least the way these companies pitch it to consumers, is that they're hoping to help drive costs down for the consumers. If anything, I think it might make things more simple for consumers if, you know, you're dealing just with your one health insurance company and the pharmacy benefits company is tucked into them. It might be a little more simple for consumers to deal with.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Today, President Trump praised lawmakers in Florida for passing gun restrictions last night. The bill is now in the hands of Governor Rick Scott. It goes further than the governor wanted because it would allow some teachers to carry guns in schools. It falls short of what some families affected by the Parkland school shooting wanted, which is a ban on semi-automatic weapons. And the measure defies the National Rifle Association because it raises the minimum age to buy rifles to 21, bans devices known as bump stocks, and creates a three-day waiting period to buy a gun. Joining us is Sasha Cordner. She's host and reporter at WFSU in Tallahassee. And Sasha, this was an emotional debate. It was a very close vote. It was bipartisan. How big of a deal was it for the Florida legislature to pass this?
This was a very big deal that it actually even passed, because if you'd asked anyone if this was a possibility last year, let alone a few weeks ago before that mass high school shooting, you'd actually probably having people looking at you like you're crazy, because even those who voted against the bill were a mixture of Democrats and Republicans who either said the bill went too far or didn't go far enough. Like, some Republicans did not like the raising the minimum age to buy a gun to 21, or even the ban on bump stocks, which are actually add-ons that can allow a semi-automatic weapon to fire like an automatic weapon with the pull of a single trigger. And as for some Democrats, they're actually against the inclusion of the formerly called school marshal program, now called the Guardian program.
Let's talk about that, because that is one of the most controversial parts of this bill. But it seems like there's a provision in the Guardian program language that would exclude some teachers. In other words, if you only teach, you wouldn't be able to bring a gun into the classroom. Is that right?
Right. It's a voluntary program that would allow for certain designated people who have completed law enforcement training and have been deputized to have a gun on school grounds. When the measure came up in the Senate over the weekend, they agreed to limit it since it was giving even some Republicans some heartburn. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to note that Florida Senate President Joe Negron said that classroom teachers' exclusion actually got the measure over the finish line.
But 10 heads of the state's largest school systems are basically saying they have no intention of moving forward with that in their own schools. Are others in support of it?
That's a bit of a toss-up. While some schools are actually saying no, that they don't want to do this, others are saying yes. And also school superintendents and the local sheriff's offices both have to agree on that. And lawmakers have actually been in talks with school superintendents and local sheriff's offices about this. Some counties are saying yes, and some counties are saying no.
Well, there is a provision that would allow police to seize the weapons of mentally ill people who pose a threat, something called a red flag law, which is what we've reported on this program. But here's Governor Scott, who, of course, is a Republican, talking about whether or not he'll sign or veto this bill.
I'm going to review the bill line by line. And the group that I'm going to be talking to, the groups that I care the most about right now because it impacted them so much, is the families.
What is Governor Scott's political calculus here? He's been said to be weighing a run for the U.S. Senate. He's got the NRA to contend with. What's his thinking now?
Well, he has said, yes, I am a proud member of the NRA. But he actually seems to be... I don't want to say that he's leaning towards actually signing that bill, but I know that, you know, you had like some of the parents actually come even recently, some of the parents who actually lost some of their teenagers talking to Governor Rick Scott and talking to members of the cabinet the other day, saying that, you know, these bills aren't perfect, but at least let's just pass something.
Yeah. Here's Andrew Pollack, whose daughter Meadow was killed in the shooting.
Nothing in life's ever perfect, but a majority of this bill is going to help the communities.
Do the victims' families actually believe that the language in this gun bill would help prevent a future shooting?
I think they believe that there are some very good portions contained in this bill that could actually be helpful, like raising that minimum age to require anyone to buy a gun to 21 because the shooter was actually 19. There's also some things about, you know, the ban on bump stocks, which has been that add-on that has been that has actually popped up in some of these mass shootings. And then also, as you'd mentioned, the provision that allowed law enforcement to seize weapons from a person deemed mentally ill and will likely pose a threat. And, you know, there's a whole list of provisions that they said that they are very much in favor of. The only thing that people have said that they're not too certain of is that arming teachers provision.
All right. Sasha Cordner is host and reporter at WFSU in Tallahassee. Sasha, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And one of the lingering questions from the Parkland shooting is why law enforcement officials didn't follow up on multiple tips about the accused killer. In a briefing this week, the FBI told lawmakers that its agents did connect two separate tips about Nicholas Cruz, but still failed to act. Local authorities also got a tip about Cruz. The state's child welfare agency was investigating him, too. And as NPR's Joel Rose reports, there's only one person who was in a position to bridge the information gap between state and local authorities.
Scott Peterson was a sheriff's deputy assigned to be the school resource officer, basically the school cop, at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School since 2009. Maybe you've heard of him because he resigned the week after the shooting.
Devastated, sick to my stomach.
That was Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel describing surveillance video footage that shows Peterson waiting outside the school building instead of rushing in to confront the shooter. Peterson's lawyer disputes that account and insists he is not a coward. But those aren't the only questions about Peterson or his role in the Parkland shooting. Until a few weeks ago, Peterson was a model police officer. He won an award in 2014 as School Resource Officer of the Year in Broward County. That's the year Rachel Kravatsky graduated from Stoneman Douglas.
To me, he always kind of seemed like this big, cuddly teddy bear kind of guy. He always seemed to me like this nice guy in a police uniform on campus.
Peterson's lawyer declined our request for an interview, but we do have a recording of Peterson speaking before the Broward County School Board in 2012.
I've been a police officer for 30 years. I've been a school resource officer for 25 years.
Peterson talks about a program that pays for police officers to live on school campuses to help prevent crime. And he tells a couple of stories about catching the bad guys.
I chased them. I'm getting older, but I started chasing them. I jumped into my car. I apprehended two of them at the 4800 block of Coconut Creek.
Peterson comes off as funny, self-deprecating, approachable. And for a school resource officer, that's part of the job, to be a mentor for students. But it's not the only part. Back in early 2016, the Broward Sheriff's Office got a tip that Nicholas Cruz, the alleged Parkland shooter, had posted on Instagram that he planned to, quote, shoot up a school. The Sheriff's Office says that tip was referred to the school resource officer at Stoneman Douglas, Scott Peterson. There's no evidence that he followed up.
From the time a tip like that comes in, they have to be aggressively investigated.
Curtis Lavarello is a former school resource officer in Florida. Now he directs the School Safety Advocacy Council, which advises schools on security. After that tip about Cruz, Lavarello says the sheriff's office should have been trying to find out everything it could about him, from state agencies, from schools, from mental health providers.
All of those are pieces to the puzzle that would have to be put together. Not that Peterson, the SRO, is responsible for the whole entire psychological profile, but he plays a crucial part in collecting some of the data and the information and at least forwarding to a state agency to see if we're starting to look at a young man.
But in at least one incident, Peterson refused to cooperate with investigators from the Florida Department of Children and Families. The agency got involved in fall of 2016 after Cruz cut himself and posted about it on social media. According to a DCF report, Peterson, quote, refused to share any information, unquote, about an incident involving Cruz. Peterson's lawyer did not reply to a request for comment. Mac Hardy is with the National Association of School Resource Officers. He says we should wait for more answers before blaming Scott Peterson, but he also said this.
Communication is the key. When you're doing this job right, you're diverting these incidents from occurring because you have open lines of communication.
Lines of communication that did not seem to be open at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Joel Rose, NPR News, Parkland, Florida.
The legal battle between President Trump and the porn star known as Stormy Daniels is heating up. Daniels, whose real name is Stephanie Clifford, sued Trump this week, alleging he hadn't signed a non-disclosure agreement that would have prevented her from discussing their alleged affair in 2006. Then we learned the White House had filed a restraining order against Clifford last month to stop her from speaking out. For more on this, we're joined by Dylan Matthews, a staff writer for Vox. Dylan, does it matter if Trump never signed that agreement?
I'm not a lawyer, so I can't give too precise advice on this, but that's her main argument in the suit. Trump used the alias David Dennison throughout this, and neither Donald Trump nor David Dennison signed the non-disclosure agreement that's at issue. There are certain cases where lawyers are allowed to sign things like that on their client's behalf, and so the argument that Trump and his team are going to make is that Michael Cohen, his personal attorney, was acting in Trump's stead and had the authority to do that. And so the argument that Ms. Clifford is going to make and her attorney is going to make is that a non-disclosure agreement is a significant enough agreement that it needed Trump's signature to be binding.
The press secretary at the White House, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, was asked about all this yesterday, and she introduced a new wrinkle in the story. Let's listen to a bit of her exchange with a reporter at the White House.
Look, the president has addressed these directly and made very well clear that none of these allegations are true. This case has already been won in arbitration, and anything beyond that, I would refer you to the president's outside counsel.
And then later, Stormy Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, responded to that claim of having already won in arbitration from Sanders, calling it bogus and baseless. Here he is speaking to CNN's Anderson Cooper last night.
Anderson, at this point, you know about as much about this arbitration as we do.
because nobody bothered to tell us about it before it happened. Nobody bothered to invite my client to the party, if you will, which makes the issuance of this order even that much more curious, that it happened within a matter of hours, all in an effort, and I want to be really clear about this, all in an effort to keep this matter under wraps, keep it out of public view, hide the facts, and silence my client.
Dylan Matthews, tell us more about this part of the story, the arbitration aspect.
So it's common in contracts like this to specify that disputes about the contract or about violations of the contract will be addressed in private, confidential arbitration rather than an open court. That's sort of the whole point of a non-disclosure agreement. If all your disagreements about it were aired in open court, then you'd be disclosing everything. And so what appears to have happened is that Trump and his team worked with a private arbiter and got a ruling from that arbiter enjoining Daniels to stop talking about her affair with Trump, basically. The claim from Avenatti is that they were not invited, and so the arbitration was not valid. And to Sanders' claim, this is not settled. The entire point of the lawsuit that was filed is that they don't feel like the ruling in arbitration is valid, and they want to bring the matter up in a formal court. So it's entirely possible that Trump and his team will prevail, that the non-disclosure agreement will be held up in federal court and in whatever courts they appeal to. But it's not a settled matter yet. It's still evolving, and it's also entirely possible that Stormy Daniels will win and earn the right to speak about this in whatever way she pleases.
And what are the political consequences of all of this for the White House?
It's hard to say that this isn't exactly who we knew Donald Trump to be. He famously cheated on his first wife with his second wife. This is hardly the first case where he's been accused of adultery during his marriage to Melania. So there's a degree to which this is just confirming that he was who we thought he was. And further, it's to some degree a distraction or sort of changes the subject a bit from the multiple credible allegations of sexual assault and sexual harassment against him from various women who accuse him of groping, of unwanted sexual touching. And by all accounts, this was a consensual affair. So if I had to guess, it's hard for me to see this being the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Well, especially because even if this had come out before the election, it would have still been after the Access Hollywood tape, which obviously did not stop him from becoming president.
Right. And it's tricky. In a very close presidential election, any little thing matters. I know there are some political scientists who think that the timing of FBI Director James Comey coming out and saying that they were looking at additional Hillary Clinton emails might have tipped the scales and won him the election. In many ways, what's more interesting is that Trump appears to have gone to great lengths, including enlisting his personal attorney to create a number of shell companies to make $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels to make this go away and to make sure it didn't come up in the month before the election. And I think that might, if anything, feel more foreign. And it's a reminder that he sort of lives in a rarefied world of wealth that is hard for a lot of his supporters to identify with.
That's Dylan Matthews, who's a staff writer at Vox. Dylan, probably more to come on this story. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks again.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.